Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
So it's my huge pleasure today to be joined on the G word by Matt Clifford. Matt is the co-founder with Alice Bentinck of Entrepreneur First, which is a deep tech talent investor and company generation machine. He's a wide-ranging thinker. And Matt, you share your thoughts in the weekly missive Matt's Thoughts in Between and cover all sorts of things from science to economics to technology to talent investing and the long-term future. Welcome to the pod.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I should declare just briefly at the beginning that we are old friends and I was an informal advisor to Entrepreneur First in the early days, but have no ongoing interest. So let's dive in. So I'd love to start with Entrepreneur First, which some of our listeners may be very familiar with, others may not have heard about. What does it do? How did you guys get started back in 2011?
Yes, the thesis for Entrepreneur First is that the world's missing out on many of its best founders. So we start from the premise that starting a company is really quite a weird thing to choose to do in most of the world. You know, Chris, you and I met because we both were management consultants at the start of our careers. And, you know, I don't know why you became a management consultant, and but partly I think it's probably like me because it's what lots of people did. And, you know, actually happened to be a great experience, I think, for both of us. And, you know, you learn lots doing that. But ultimately, I think one thing that we often forget is that career paths are really culturally determined. And certainly in the UK for a long time, I hope it's changing now, maybe at least in small part because of our work, starting a company was just not on the list of things that you did if you were ambitious. And as a result, there's a big opportunity, we think, to create more world-changing companies by encouraging the kinds of people who would be great entrepreneurs to actually start companies. So as you say, we started doing this in 2011, initially with a lot of help from McKinsey, who really kind of helped us get set up. And to begin with, we focused on trying to encourage UK graduates to start companies, as in people coming straight out of university. We would embed them in a community of other people like them, help them find a co-founder, help them select an idea. And that worked pretty well. And so over the last 10 years, we've ended up rolling this out globally. We now do it in 6 cities around the world, recruit about 800 entrepreneurs a year and take them on a company building journey from individual through to team, through to a funded company and hopefully ultimately sort of scale up doing something, solving an important problem in a hard space.
Fantastic. And bring that to life to us a bit with some examples. What kind of companies are we talking about that, or what kinds of fields do the founders operate in?
We typically, although not exclusively, focus on founders who have a fairly deep technical background. Probably about 70% of the people that join us have some sort of technical background. You know, we like to say that, you know, companies are very diverse, but what they have in common is they're solving hard problems in big markets. Quite often that means that we have an appetite for taking on technical risk that maybe some other investors don't. You know, we've backed some people doing some quite fundamentally difficult things. Never sort of science projects, but sort of the next stage after that of really translating research into the real world. So, you know, we've got everything from, you know, as I say, fairly fundamental biology, for example, sort of how do you do cell-free biomanufacturing at scale, right through to some sort of much more consumer-facing stuff. So one of our big success stories so far of the pandemic is a company called Dishpatch, which delivers restaurant meals, you know, kind of nationwide.
Suddenly a hot topic,
yeah. I'd say our core business is really working with technical founders to turn fairly cutting-edge technology into a real-world impact.
Fantastic. And some of our listeners, we're starting to get a handle on who's listening to this thing. And some of them are students, PhD students, postdocs in genomics, biotech more broadly, and so on. If some of them are interested in turning the stuff they've been working on in their postdoc into a company. What does Entrepreneur First look for, I guess, both in the idea and in the founding team? What would give them a sense of this is something we should think seriously about?
Well, first thing I say is hello. you are our core target market. We think people with that sort of background can be fantastic founders. And I think that's a message that is actually underexposed to people doing PhDs and postdocs in general in the sciences. But we sort of take the approach that every great company needs an answer to the question, why now? Like, why is now the time to start this? Why hasn't it been done before? And very often, if you're working on something technically hard that's only just become possible, that's a really great answer. So actually, people at a cutting edge of a field in biology and any kind of science, often that's a great reason. So how does EF help with that? Well, you know, Entrepreneur First, we take the approach that we're investing in the person, not the idea. So what you absolutely do not need to come through our door is a fully fledged sense of exactly what it is you're going to build, how you're going to build it, what the plan is, or even who you're going to work with. We really are backing people as individuals, and then we certainly won't do everything else. The founders do the hard work, but we will help facilitate everything else, whether it's finding the co-founder who's going to be the right partner for you to build something big, whether it's selecting the idea that could reach venture scale and become something important, or whether it's taking those first few steps through like finding the right initial customer, figuring out what to prioritize, what are the milestones that will be important to hit in order to raise capital, all those things. So the sort of tagline would be, you know, join as an individual, leave as a funded company.
You've given the pitch before. it's a strong tagline. And you mentioned, complex and emerging areas of manufacturing as an example earlier. At Genomics England, speaking of taglines, we turn science into healthcare using technology. And the science and the healthcare bit are fundamental. But I think over the last few years, the technology bit has really risen in prominence as the vehicle through which the science and the healthcare happen. As we're increasingly seeing that biology is technology, what kind of fields are you seeing interesting founders emerge in? And how do you, as either an individual or as a company, have any sense of whether these are promising, whether the time is right? Because they're often so niche, I guess. Like, how do you get your head around that whole space?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to say that we're willing to take on a lot of risk, which is a polite way of saying a lot of things don't work out. And so, I think something I always want to flag at the beginning that I don't think there is a reliable way to know whether something will work out. I suppose maybe our starting point would be to say something like, probably now 12 years ago, Marc Andreessen, the sort of co-inventor of the web browser and now prominent venture capitalist, wrote this very influential essay with the title "Software is Eating the World." And the thesis that he was getting at there is exactly as you say: more and more things that felt like problems about atoms are increasingly problems about bits. More and more things are software problems. And so we have invested in bio-based companies that do very little with software other than, sort of send emails. But in general, what we're really interested in is problems where biology has become an information problem. And there is a sort of sweet spot where, say, if you remember, founders are meeting at EF and building companies from the intersection of their expertise. What we love doing is finding companies where two people can meet at EF and, maybe one is an expert in biology and one is an expert in machine learning, and there's something that they realize about what they're capable of together that is more than the sum of what they would be able to do alone. And so I suppose what we're particularly interested in is, where do techniques from, say, computer science enable us to do things with biology that otherwise might not be possible? So probably the sort of most familiar idea is sort of drug discovery, which is, a field we've done some work in, which is like one way to think about that is as a search space that, no one human can search across that whole space. It's actually very hard for computers to do that too, but there are ways that you can sort of frame the problem that make that more doable. We, though, in general, one thing we always say is we like to be surprised by founders. Like what we don't do, unlike, say, an organization like Flagship, where, they have some great ideas and they go out and find the right people to build them. We always joke, we don't have very good ideas. We want founders to have the ideas. So, we're particularly interested in people that can bring, you know, a deep understanding of an old problem and suggest new solutions.
And what are you seeing at the moment in terms of, I don't know if it's too sort of cheesy an idea to say, like, hot ideas, you know, where are these things coming together around where there's an interesting biology problem that emerging computer science techniques can really get moving? You mentioned drug discovery. Are there other things that are popping up and surprising you, like the sort of stereotypical, you know, asteroid mining approaches to life, sort of unconventional approaches to old problems?
I think one thing we're very interested in, which I guess is an idea that is increasingly, there are increasing number of examples of, is where can you use techniques from computer science to design and run experiments in the real world that allow us to learn, iterate, and select more and more relevant and valuable experiments to run in a sort of closed loop. And, you know, one company that you and I are both familiar with that would be a great example of this is Lab Genius, a company based out of London that sort of combines techniques from machine learning and biology to sort of, as I say, run these experiments in a closed loop. Sadly, that's not an EF company, but we have some similar ones in different sort of non-competitive fields. And, you know, there's now some very big companies in that space, companies like Recursion and Zymergen, where they're able to basically say, what if we let the machines do the experiments? I think that's a very cool idea. And I think that idea is a platform approach to finding whether it's valuable proteins, valuable drugs, valuable chemicals is a really, really exciting space.
Just to bring to life this concept of the sort of closed loop. So what you're saying is there's a traditional model, I guess, of experiment design where the human being thinks about something, has an idea, asks a question, and pulls together the relevant data that they think they need to answer the question, uses the computer to kind of crunch the data and get the results. And then the human looks at the results and says, ah, okay, that experiment worked, or it didn't work, or we proved this hypothesis, or we didn't prove this hypothesis. Let's have a think about what we do next. And we're saying there's a new paradigm emerging where actually we can set a framework or a problem that we're trying to solve, and that whole process from asking questions, selecting data, running algorithms, establishing whether something has worked or not, and then figuring out the next steps, that whole loop can be run at kind of machine scale.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one way of thinking about it is like, how do you, you know, if you think about a search space where, you know, you say like there's almost infinite number of, let's say, sort of candidate molecules for a therapy that might be valuable. How do you find the ones that are most valuable? Well, one way is to start with sort of exactly as you say, like a human sense of what promising areas might be. But if you then can use a machine to sort of iterate variations of that and see which of those are most promising, select and then iterate versions of that most promising one. I mean, I'm simplifying and, you know, I'm sure that Lab Genius and others would say there's a horrible butchering of what they do. But one way of thinking about it is that you're basically starting with an impossibly vast search space and using the machine's ability to search across that to narrow down on sort of ever more promising experiments to run and learn from. And as you say, if you can actually hook it up so that that happens without a human having to intervene, you can do things much, much quicker than you would do in a conventional process.
Absolutely. And this may be stretching a metaphor, but it feels like almost an evolutionary approach, right? We're seeing what survives and what doesn't, and then we kind of derive a next generation from what's been most successful. It's interesting how these kind of concepts come back. In fact, my colleagues at Genomics England always pull me up for using the word evolve in a loose sense. I'll say things like, well, we need to help evolve the way that we're doing this in this NHS pathway. And they're like, so what, we should just do it a million times over thousands of years and see which method is the most successful, and then that one will set criteria by which they succeed or fail, and then that one is the one we'll pick. I was like, okay, maybe I mean transform.
Right. Exactly.
So okay, fascinating. So this concept of effectively, because of the computational power and the scale of data that we can now throw at these problems, we can effectively boil that ocean and see what works and what
exactly.
Doesn't.
And you know, my one of our venture partners is a guy that some of your listeners might have heard of, a guy called Benedict Evans, who writes a really great newsletter on technology and has for many years produced some of the best research on thinking about how paradigms change in tech. And, you know, he has this analogy of like, what can machine learning do? You know, it's like being able to have a million interns. It's not that they can do everything that your core business needs to be able to do, but there are some things they can do very well. And if you can have a million of them, then there are things you can achieve with that that would be almost impossible to achieve with human scale, human normal numbers of people. So yeah, that's just one way of thinking about the power of machine learning in these spaces. But I think if you take that idea and say that's kind of where the technology is at the moment, that you can basically just massively parallelize a lot of processes, that yields, I think, a lot of quite exciting opportunities.
Yeah, and the scale of data storage and compute that we can throw at these things, there's that kind of business cliche, come on guys, let's not boil the ocean here. It's like, well, it turns out if you've got a sodding great kettle, you know, you actually can just do that. And speaking of data, at Genomics England, we have a long-standing partnership with the NHS. On the basis of that partnership, holds huge amounts of patient data, which we're very sort of careful custodians of. For a startup company, a couple of people have come out of postdoc. They've got a great idea. How do they think about accessing data?
Well, it's a great question. It's often is the barrier to a totally new startup getting going, because, you know, partly building data sets is expensive. Partly, as you sort of hinted at there, there's a lot of security and privacy concerns, particularly around health data. And so actually very often it's the question is the right question for a sort of health or bio leaning machine learning startup is like, where are you going to get the data? And if the founders often think about it being like when we say it's a technology problem, we think of it being like an IP problem. Like, do you have a smart enough solution? But actually it's very often it's like, do you have a great data generation or a data acquisition approach? I mean, there are lots of different ways to achieve that. And like any startup journey, it's often about what can you do incrementally that actually compounds in value over time. So sometimes the way to do that is academic partnerships at the beginning, or, you know, partnerships with, in the UK, NHS trusts. We've had a lot of success with startups partnering with hospitals in Singapore, where we have an office. Initially on like fairly small scale academic style studies, but it gives, you know, a leg up to, you know, build the next version that builds credibility and trust and allows deeper partnerships. But I think there's also some interesting things starting to happen in healthcare that have been promising approaches outside healthcare for a while, which is, you know, how do you use your users as data generators? You know, how do you create, again, we're sort of using the metaphor of a closed loop, meaning if you imagine the human is somehow generating data, maybe they're, to use a kind of common healthcare diagnostics example, you know, maybe they're taking pictures of suspicious moles that they have, and they're, you know, they're worried whether they have skin cancer. Well, actually, if you have a million people using that app and, you know, they're self-labeling contextual information about that data, you're obviously keeping the images extremely secure and confidential. They're not being shared, but the model that's trained on top of those becomes more and more accurate as you get more and more data through it. That's another approach. And, you know, we've seen that work in totally non-bio healthcare context like insurance. But I think increasingly it's an approach that's being used across the board.
Yeah, and certainly in genomics, we've seen with private companies like 23andMe, for example, being able to build extraordinarily scale data sets on the basis of the consent of people who are using their service for their own purposes.
Yeah, and I think in a way it's that classic sort of, if you think about who your early adopters are, if you're doing something where the long-term impact of getting it right is high, you often can get, you know, what small in absolute terms number of fanatical users who will literally, in one example, I think I can say this, like send you their poop in the mail so that you can analyze it. Now, I don't think you could run a TV ad for that right now and get a million samples, but there are people that, you know, if you have either rare diseases or if you're, you know, if you have a particular health problem where the answer to this kind of an analytics this startup might do is valuable, probably get 1,000 people to do that. before you know it, you might have one of the world's more important poop databases. And then, you know, from there, you can build it. It sort of sounds like a silly example, but I think it's somewhat analogous to the 23andMe. You know, it's sort of informed consent from participants who get something of value from it, but it allows your model to get to the stage where it can be, you know, sort of valuable to non-fanatics as well over the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. I should actually just at this point say that all of the data which we hold de-identified of hundreds of thousands of genomes and all of the associated clinical data is available for startups to use if they want to. And startups, science experiments, hospital trusts, partnerships with hospitals in Singapore, I think there's something of a perception that startups are kind of interesting, but don't necessarily scale and really have impact at kind of system scale. There was a fantastic advert I saw once back in the days when we used to actually go places in Basel Airport, which was a black and white photo of four people in a chemist's shop in Basel in 1860. And it said co-founders Roche, 1860. And we forget that all right. of these gargantuan companies that we think of today were once a handful of people and a pharmacy shop in Basel. How can we actually get startups to scale and then to really have that kind of impact on the global stage?
It's a huge and important question. And I suppose the good and bad news is that if you look at somewhere like Silicon Valley, one of the key and underrated ingredients is time. You know, so like Silicon Valley really got its start arguably in the aftermath of the Second World War, and it's taken 75 years of slow compounding to get to where it was today. Now, the good news is it's a little while. It's clearly been pretty exciting what's happened in Silicon Valley for a little while. So I'm not saying kind of wait 75 years and come back. But I think sometimes policymakers in particular, when facing the question of like, how do we build a vibrant startup ecosystem, forget that it takes time. And I think one of the great things that we're seeing in the UK today is that the taking time bit has been going for, you know, well over a decade now, a couple of decades, arguably. And so what you are getting is what I think is one of the key secrets of Silicon Valley success, which is network density. You know, if you start a company today, it's not that hard to suddenly be in contact with people who have done it before and are recycling their capital and their knowledge into new startups. They know about, you know, the pitfalls that they faced, and, you know, they want to help people navigate them themselves. So I suppose it's a slightly flippant answer, but, you know, partly I think time, you know, patience is key. I mean, obviously, I'm slightly talking my own book here, but I do think the other really key ingredient is talent. One of the things that Silicon Valley has that the rest of the world doesn't is that starting a company is, I would go so far as to say, like the default path for the most ambitious people in Silicon Valley. It's sort of, it'd be crazy for you to go to Goldman Sachs if you could start your own company in Silicon Valley. And it's one of the few places in the world that that's true. I think it is changing pretty rapidly in the UK. I think it's really exciting to see the sort of level of excitement around startups today relative to, say, 2011. But I do think that one thing we're sometimes as a society a bit uncomfortable about saying is that startups, and particularly technology startups, are a sort of like high skill vocation, as in it really matters who starts them. And in general, you know, startups do need a great answer to that why now question. And particularly in the tech startup side of things, that means that you need some of your most skilled, talented researchers, professionals to start companies for them to become significant. So that's the second ingredient. And the third is, of course, capital. And, you know, I think it's the bit that gets a lot of the attention, you know, like how do we get more venture capital in the UK or Europe? It's an important question, but I think it's overrated. I think actually capital markets are, for better or worse, very efficient. And, you know, it's definitely true that there are some startups that maybe don't do as well as they might because they're sort of born in a capital poor ecosystem versus Silicon Valley, but that's changing very rapidly. And I have to say, it's one of the trends that the pandemic has accelerated is that more allocators of venture capital are comfortable investing from their Silicon Valley bedrooms or living rooms to companies all over the world. And so less and less do I worry that, you know, we're going to build great companies in the UK that just sort of get starved of capital. I think actually that's not true anymore. And I think that should be really encouraging for aspiring founders.
That's great to hear. And we're contributing to a refresh of the life sciences strategy from a couple of years ago. And one of the targets there was that we should have two life sciences unicorns in the UK over the next 5 to 10 years. If you were going to pick an area, which area do you think that that could emerge from? And if you were Prime Minister, what would you do to try and make that happen?
Ah, nice, easy questions. Well, the good news is it would probably, the good news for any Prime Minister is that would probably happen anywhere. I mean, I think the momentum is there, and that's really cool. I mean, like, one of the jokes I often make is that the nice thing about venture capital is that, you know, sort of 10 years later, you get credit for work that's long gone, and, you know, you don't really have to do anything except wait. Obviously, the founders do, and as I said before, they're the ones doing the hard work. I mean, I think areas that I suspect are likely places for future life sciences unicorns, maybe if I were to use an analogy, arguably the most important thing that's happened for digital startups, not life sciences, over the last 15 years is the emergence of things like Amazon Web Services, cloud computing, and sort of relatedly or semi-relatedly open source software. And the reason is that innovation is hard, and ideally a company that is innovative actually should innovate as little as possible. It should innovate in a very focused area where they're genuinely the best in the world, and hopefully do everything else off the shelf, like reusable components. And between cloud computing and open source software on the digital side, that's just made innovation a lot easier. You know, software companies today really do only have to focus on the very, very small part of the whole stack of what they do that's new. That's happening in life sciences, but it's definitely not at the same level of advancement as the sort of AWS on the digital side. It's often said that Amazon Web Services is effectively the biggest beneficiary of venture capital globally, because about 20% of all VC funding seems to go into it. So it's just like the ultimate, they're effectively taking carry on every VC funds everywhere in the world. But I think there is almost certainly, you know, 10 years from now, we'll be talking about a company that has a similar impact in the life sciences. That, you know, I suppose a good way to generate startup ideas in any field is to say, what are lots of companies having to build from scratch themselves that could be provided as a platform or interface? I suspect that there are multiple unicorns to be built in delivering AWS-like services to life sciences. So that's probably the area I'm personally most excited about. And as I say, I don't think it's one company. I think there are lots of building blocks here that will be used again and again and again. And so if you're long life sciences innovation, you should be very, very long the people selling the picks and shovels, as it were, to that group.
In this case, the mice and synthetic DNA. Exactly.
In the terms of what you would do if you were Prime Minister to try and accelerate this, well, I think there are a few things. I think one would be to think about how can we make it really easy to do technology transfer. This is a very hot topic at the moment. My friend Nathan Banayak had a great column in the FT a week ago on, you know, kind of how the way we do tech transfer culturally in the UK is holding us back compared to the US. I was very fortunate to study at MIT as a graduate student, and, you know, basically their philosophy, I'm caricaturing, is sort of take what you want, do with it what you want, and hopefully you'll make a billion and give us 100 million, you know. And that's not the approach we've generally taken in the UK. We've generally sort of, I would say, been short-term greedy in the UK, trying to, you know, when we do tech transfer out of UK universities, again, not every university, but, you know, as a caricature, you know, take a lot of equity up front or demand royalties for a long time or golden shares that affect the governance of the company. And that just makes it very hard to succeed. It disincentivizes founders, so some companies just don't get started at all. And the ones that do often are not able to raise capital from the best investors and access the best markets because there's just so many ties that sort of restrict them. So I do think there's a huge amount of leverage in just making it easy to, you know, we do have in the UK genuinely world-class universities across the whole of the life sciences, and I think making it easy for the best of that to become companies is like one of the big areas we could do better in.
Part of the intent of this podcast series is to have a national conversation about genomics. We're talking to all sorts of people: faith leaders, charity leaders, researchers, politicians, practitioners. As genomics comes more and more into the mainstream, it's becoming part of the mainstream of NHS care. Consumer genomics is becoming a big thing. And there are still lots of unanswered questions around where do we draw boundaries on on data usage, on the implications of one person's data having an impact on another person because of relatedness, on gene editing, gene therapies, and so on. If you had any thoughts or questions, what are the topics that you would want us to draw out through this series? Or are there any people that you think we should get on here to bring their voice into the conversation?
I think the key here, and it's something that I've been thinking about quite a lot, not necessarily through just the lens of genomics, but medical data in general, is that I think it's become one of those ideas, medical data, that sort of sends chills down people's spines, that there must be all sorts of nefarious things to which this data can be put to use. And I'm sure that is true in sort of various edge case scenarios. But I do think in general that the conversation around data relating to our bodies and our health and, you know, who we are, has skewed way too much towards the negative. And I totally appreciate that there are absolutely legitimate concerns, but I think sometimes what's lacking is concreteness. Like, when people talk about these things, what are the actual risks that we face, and, you know, how do we mitigate them? In every aspect of our lives, we face trade-offs around risk and reward. And in general, I think actually the public is pretty good at evaluating, once they have the information, pretty good at evaluating those. And I suspect you can tell me if this resonates or not in specifically in the genomic space, but when I think about medical care records, for example, I think a lot of the conversation has been pretty unhelpful around them, and actually the benefits of sort of better sharing of that between, you know, kind of different clinical medical practitioners has probably been set back by that. So in terms of like who you should have on the show, I think a great conversation to kickstart is really like, what are the actual risks here? How can we get really concrete about them? How can they be mitigated? And what are the upsides from actually doing this well and from being willing to take some of that risk? I think sometimes we start from the point of view that risk needs to be taken to zero before we can do anything. I think that's generally not going to be the right approach for healthcare related things. And, you know, I think, as I say, I have a lot of faith in people's ability to make risk reward trade-offs if they understand what those two things are.
I think the Kate Bingham experience on vaccines, I think, is a really helpful boost to that conversation around portfolio mindset, taking risks, making some bets that don't pay off, as you talked about earlier with, you know, both the entrepreneur first model and generally the VC model. Of course, some stuff doesn't work out, but the stuff that does work out more than makes the difference, right? But I agree with you. I think there is still a sense of risk aversion rather than risk management or sort of understanding. And it's interesting. We have a fantastic ethics team at Genomics England, and we have an ethics advisory board chaired by a wonderful professor of ethics. And one of the things that I've been really interested in and kind of pushing them on is, what are the real actual ethical questions here? What are the harms to human beings if we get those wrong? What are the benefits if we get them right? Because an observation that I've had since coming into this field a couple of years ago is that a lot of what's called ethics is actually just process. It's a research ethics committee. We need to review the text of this email. We need to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we've actually split our team at Genomics England into two. One is ethics ops, and one is what we're calling like ethics kind of fundamental unknown questions, of which there are tons. Because yeah. Otherwise, I think the risk is that we spend all of our ethics energy on getting through the next committee, when actually there are some really big, as you say, kind of.
Yeah, there's a danger that it's actually counterproductive, even if you actually take quite a risk averse perspective, in that there's a danger of ethics theater where, you know, we sort of visibly follow all the right processes, but don't actually necessarily end up with a fundamental understanding that accords with people's intuitions or preferences. And, I think, you know, across a lot of areas of human endeavor, there is always that danger of process theater. I'm not saying that's obviously happening at Genomics England, but I think in general, the content is very different. But, you know, we have similar questions. You know, we manage institutional and individual funds as the core part of our business, and obviously we're a regulated business, and compliance is a really important part of what we do, both in terms of process and culture. But, you know, one thing we're always struggling against is, like, you know, how do we make sure that we're not just appearing to do the right thing, but actually really addressing real risks to our customers here or to the public. And process is important. It needs to be followed. But I think there's a danger that it clouds us from having the real conversation.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned earlier the phrase informed choice, right, which suggests a few things. One is a process of informing so that people actually have access to information, can process it, can learn, can engage their brains on that topic. And then also this concept of agency, right? That I have the agency to make a choice. It's interesting, the participant panel that we have at Genomics England can actually say no to any research proposal on the data. They have a veto, which only the Secretary of State can overturn. I can't overturn it. Our board can't overturn it, and so on. And that feels like real agency. And I think that's such an important piece as we do have this conversation. Okay, so data, real harms, real choices, real opportunities. Okay, we've got our marching orders.
The only thing I'd add is that I think sometimes we can, when we're working with like highly technical topics like genomics or machine learning or any of these things, I think there's a real danger of underestimating the public on these things. And, you know, the reality is it's very easy to sit where we sit and imagine that, you know, we're sort of some sort of priestly caste that understands the technology and, you know, kind of how can we possibly get the public to have informed consent on these things? They're so complicated. But how many of us really know how an internal combustion engine works, right? You know what I mean? All day, every day, all of us, however technically proficient, have to and do put our faith in technologies that we don't fully understand the inner workings of. But we'd be highly patronized if people said to us, well, you know, we need to, you can't really have informed consent to drive a car because you don't really understand how it works. And I think actually people are really good at this. It's just about figuring out how do we get to the point where the fundamental issues rather than the, you know, the sort of, say, either the theater or the sort of cosmetic issues are understood well enough. And I'm pretty optimistic about our ability, our meaning, you know, kind of people in our sort of broad industry to enter into really productive partnership with customers, with users on that's a win-win.
What a great note to end it on. And thank God I don't need to understand how a TV works in order to watch a movie.
Exactly.
Excellent. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. And we look forward to seeing where this field takes us.
Thanks so much. It's been great to be here.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.